So last time we were preparing for the cycle, in the final chapter of this unit, we're going to actually look at the cycle itself. And the cycle, of course, is variously called the tricarboxylic acid cycle, or the citric acid cycle, or the Krebs cycle, eponymously. And we see a very basic summary of the citric acid cycle in this first slide. No, not very many details are shown here, but we can see the main inputs and outputs. Well, the main input as far as fuel is concerned is the 2-carbon acetyl group that's being carried by acetyl coenzyme A, right? And where did that come from? What process produced it? The what? That's one possibility, yeah. What is this, the first step of cellular respiration that... The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, right. That's actually just one possibility. The citric acid cycle starts by receiving acetyl coenzyme A, whatever the source is. But acetyl coenzyme A is not produced only by the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That's the source of the acetyl coenzyme A when we're talking about glucose as a starting point, or anything else that feeds into glycolysis, because glycolysis will spit out pyruvate, right? But there, as we'll see, we haven't talked about these yet, but I've halfway mentioned it before. Acetyl coenzyme A is also produced as in the oxidation of, or the catabolism of fatty acids and certain amino acids. And when that happens, acetyl coenzyme A that's produced that way is no different from the acetyl coenzyme A that is produced via oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. But we've been talking about a process that's bigger than just cellular respiration. We've been talking about the complete catabolism, the complete oxidation of glucose as the master fuel, right, which starts out with glycolysis and then proceeds through cellular respiration. Keep in mind, though, that the citric acid cycle doesn't care where it gets the acetyl coenzyme A. It could be coming from amino acids being catabolized or fatty acids being catabolized. We'll talk about the details of those later, though. Anyway, the citric acid cycle isn't going to operate as a cycle unless it receives that 2-carbon acetyl group from coenzyme A. And the reason this thing is a cycle, of course, is because it's a pathway in which the final product serves as the initial reactant. It's the thing that the final step spits out as a product also serves as the reactant in the first step. And that occurs right where acetyl coenzyme A comes in. Okay, so the citric acid cycle is a way of dealing with this fuel that came from glucose originally, if we're thinking about this in terms of glucose catabolism, but is no longer glucose. It's been partially oxidized. It's the 6-carbon sugar has been partly broken down, partly dismantled as far as the carbon skeleton is concerned. Yielding some energy along the way, right? What are the sources of energy that we've already talked about, that we've already yielded, or I mean, we've already harvested? Where was ATP formed? There was some produced in glycolysis, right? How much? A net of 2. Yeah, there were 4 produced, but you had to spend 2 to do that, right? So a net of 2 per glucose molecule. Yeah. And what was the mechanism by which that ATP was produced? Well, when ATP is produced, what's happening? What kind of reaction is that to produce ATP? What is it before it becomes ATP? ADP. So what is that process called? Phosphorylation. And what kind of phosphorylation operates in glycolysis to produce that ATP? Substrate level phosphorylation, exactly. In other words, something that's already carrying the phosphate acts as a substrate and passes that phosphate on to ADP, which is the other substrate forming the ATP. That's substrate level phosphorylation. All right, anything else? Is that the only source of the useful energy we've gotten out of the original glucose so far? NADH has also been harvested. Where? In glycolysis. How much? Two NADHs. And NADHs are useful because they're carrying electrons, right, that used to be in the glucose. Those electrons represent potential energy, because if cellular respiration is going to operate, which it is, because that's what we're studying, then those electrons will pay off in terms of energy. How? Yes, they will be delivered to electron transport chains, which are complexes of molecules, mostly proteins, embedded where? In the inner mitochondrial membrane, yes. And by doing that, by passing these electrons from member to other member of the chain, a little bit at a time of the energy that these electrons are carrying is released. And so that will finally pay off in terms of even more ATP, because of oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, which is a different type of phosphorylation compared to substrate level phosphorylation. Anything else that has been harvested as useful energy along the way before we get to the cycle? Well, the answer is yes. Your job is to tell me where, and what is it? Well, we have already gotten some CO2, that's true, but CO2 is not useful as energy. It is completely spent fuel. Where did that CO2 appear? Where did that first CO2, the only CO2 that has been produced so far, where did it occur? The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, right? Decarboxylation means that you are freeing up a CO2. It used to be a carboxyl group of something bigger. Now it's C and two O's on its own as a carbon dioxide. So, yes, that's true that that's produced in just the previous step, the last chapter step. But that's not useful energy. So what's the remaining source of useful energy that we haven't accounted for? No, there's no FADH2 produced yet. What is it? Well, pyruvate is useful fuel, but how do we extract the energy from it? Yes, where is that? Right. Oxidative decarboxylation is called that instead of just calling it decarboxylation, because oxidation is also happening. When you oxidize the fuel via dehydrogenation, in other words, the specific kind of oxidation is dehydrogenation, where do those hydrogens end up? In NADH, exactly. So Remember when we studied the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, that huge enzyme complex with the, represented by the four circles of three different colors? Part of that process, in addition to extracting a CO2 off of it, was to oxidize the carbons that were left in the fuel, sticking those hydrogens onto NAD+ to make NADH. So NADH is produced not only in glycolysis, but also in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate doesn't produce any ATP, but the NADH that's produced will power the production of multiple ATPs in oxidative phosphorylation of cellular respiration, just like the NADs produced by glycolysis will. Okay? So every time that we produce ATP in glycolysis and in the ATP that we're going to produce in the citric acid cycle, that is, if you want to think about this in terms of goals, the end of the line. The whole idea of doing this for energetic purposes is to make ATP. So once you're in the form of ATP, that's the final payoff. But always remember that the NADH that's there is going to pay off in terms of multiple ATPs per NADH if you allow oxidative phosphorylation of cellular respiration to operate. So that's where we're headed. Okay? That's the top part of this. The acetyl group of that acetyl coenzyme A is the only remaining part of what was originally a glucose molecule, and it's still fuel at this point because we have not completely dismantled that carbon skeleton. We've yielded only one CO2 at this point. That was in the previous step, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Therefore, in terms of energy metabolism, the overall goal of the citric acid cycle is to complete the oxidation of the fuel, to complete the dismantling of the carbon skeleton of what was originally glucose. Okay? At this point, though, it's only an acetyl group in acetyl coenzyme A. And therefore, to complete that dismantling and to extract the usable energy from it, that means we need to spit off those two carbons individually. Each carbon is a member of a carbon dioxide. And so the waste that comes out of the citric acid cycle is the only thing remaining from the glucose in terms of carbon. Two carbon dioxides. Now, why does that account for it completely? We've only spit off one CO2 in the decarboxylation of pyruvate. Why does two more make it complete? Why? It's all three, but why is three complete? Right? But glucose has six. Right. You have to keep in mind that everything after the split from the hexose into two trioses that happens in glycolysis, you have to multiply everything by two. So there's two oxidative decarboxylations of pyruvate because there's two pyruvate molecules. Okay? So that means there's two NADHs produced per glucose for that process. And there's two CO2s. Therefore, there's two acetyl coenzyme A's coming into the cycle individually. Each one produces two more CO2s for a total of four. Four plus the two from the previous step is the six that were originally in glucose itself. All right? At that point, there is no fuel remaining. Except as intermediates of this cycle itself, which are going to be recycled through. But because those intermediates are going to be rearranged and processed on their way back to the start-finish line of the cycle, there is still some useful energy that can be gotten that is energy that was originally locked up in glucose. And that's why we have two other important things being spit off of this cycle. 8 electrons and an ATP molecule. OK? Okay, the ATP, like I said, that's the goal. So that's the final payoff. The eight electrons are not going to actually be eight electrons on their own. Where are they going to be? Yes, they are going to be part of the hydrogens that are connected to FADH2 and NADH. Well, actually, not just hydrogen, right? NAD plus receives two electrons and a proton. But anyway, it's eight electrons that used to be in glucose that get extracted in this process. And the reason that's just listed as 8E minus here is because that's really what we care about in terms of energy. They're going to be carried by multiple different coenzymes, but they're going to be carried for the same purpose. They have the same fate, these electrons, and that same fate, regardless of whether they're being carried on NADH or FADH2, is that they are going to be delivered to electron transport chains in the mitochondrion. And when that happens, that will allow for the final step in cellular respiration, which we're going to treat in a different chapter after the test, and that is oxidative phosphorylation. That's when most of the ATP that is able to be produced because of the energy that was originally in glucose is actually made. And so that is the final big-time payoff that really makes it worth the cell's while to go beyond glycolysis and continue oxidizing the fuel via cellular respiration. It pays off in terms of a lot more ATP per original glucose molecule. Okay, let's go on to slide 2 then and look at this in greater detail. It's another picture of the cycle, and still not all the details are shown here, but it shows you a little bit more than what we saw in the previous slide. C2 is the 2-carbon compound that's being carried by coenzyme A. In other words, C2 here represents the acetyl group. And where it joins the cycle, you can think of as the start-finish line. The final product, if you broke this cycle open and thought of it just as a linear pathway, the final product is oxaloacetate, which is a C4 compound. There's 4 carbons in oxaloacetate. All right. The reason it's a cycle, though, as I was saying before, is that oxaloacetate, the final product, also serves as a reactant in the first reaction, because it reacts with the incoming acetyl coenzyme A. And it does that by condensing with coenzyme A. Remember that condensation reactions join two things together, right? So when a 4-carbon oxaloacetate molecule condenses with a 2-carbon acetyl coenzyme A, and by 2-carbon here I'm excluding the carbons that are actually in coenzyme A, the 2 carbons of the thing coenzyme A is carrying, then you now have a 6-carbon compound represented by the C6 here. Okay, that's what happens at the beginning of the cycle. And so it kind of seems like we're going backwards, because the whole idea is to dismantle the carbon skeleton, right? We've now just built up a bigger one. But it's going to pay off, because we're going to play around with that 6-carbon compound, dismantling it along the way, partially, 1 carbon dioxide at a time, 1 carboxyl group at a time. So we're going to decarboxylate it twice. And that first decarboxylation step is shown right here with the CO2 coming off to the right. But notice that decarboxylation happens simultaneously with the reduction of NAD plus into NADH. Therefore, it's not just decarboxylation, it is what? oxidative decarboxylation, just like what happened to pyruvate before the cycle. Okay, that is important because CO2 is worthless energetically, but NADH is storing some of the energy that was in the original fuel. That happens then again. We take the C5 that results after the decarboxylation and oxidatively decarboxylate it, spitting out another NADH, which is useful, and another CO2, which is waste. That leaves us, of course, now with a C4, a four-carbon compound. And the rest of the cycle is just about extracting a little bit more energy from that while rearranging the four carbons in such a way that you have oxaloacetate recycled for another round of the cycle. Once you get back to oxaloacetate, then it can receive another acetyl, coenzyme A, and the process can continue. Okay? But every turn of the cycle is going to spit out two CO2s, and therefore that is going to complete the dismantling of the original glucose carbon skeleton. Well, that rearrangement of the four carbons along the way produces ATP, or more correctly, it produces some nucleoside triphosphate. It might be ATP, it might be GTP, depending on the species or the cell, the tissue type. But even if it's not ATP, even if it's GTP, it ends the energy that's stored ends up being in ATP anyway, because GTP is going to phosphorylate in ADP to make ATP. So it might be directly what's being represented here, or indirectly, still in ATP it results. Okay? That is the goal itself, ATP. But also more energy is extracted from additional oxidation steps. There's more dehydrogenation that occurs from this. More hydrogens are picked off of this four-carbon compound, in other words, as it gets changed to different intermediates. And that's why you have the ability to reduce two more coenzymes, an FAD molecule and another NAD plus molecule. All right. So FADH2 and the three NADHs represent stored energy that aren't yet in the final form, they're not yet in ATP, but they're going to allow for the production of even more ATP when they deliver their electrons to electron transport chains. All right. Slide 3. The little gray bar here represents the inner mitochondrial membrane. And keep in mind that we've already been in the mitochondrial matrix, because that's where the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate takes place, right? So, since last chapter, we've already been in the mitochondrion. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane, so the bottom part of this represents what fluid. Below the gray line represents what fluid? Not cytosol. Not the matrix. The intermembrane space, exactly. In other words, there's another membrane here, because remember the mitochondrion is doubly membrane bounded. It's just not shown. The other membrane is below the screen. The bottom white region here represents the space between the two membranes. That's the intermembrane space. Above the gray line is the part that's fully inside the inner mitochondrial membrane, which is the mitochondrial matrix. Okay. Well, in that matrix is where the tricarboxylic acid cycle or citric acid cycle takes place. So that's where we are. And that's why you see the blue citric acid cycle being drawn here in the matrix. And notice the three purple arrows here. These represent what I've told you a little bit ago, that acetyl coenzyme A can be produced either by the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, which is represented by here by the glucose going through glycolysis, right? So glycolysis can lead to acetyl coenzyme A production, but so can oxidation of fatty acids or catabolism of amino acids, certain amino acids, which these are the parts that we'll look at later. But whatever the source of acetyl coenzyme A, that feeds directly into the cycle itself. Out pop the two carbon dioxides representing the complete oxidation of the fuel, complete dismantling of the skeleton. Out comes an ATP, which is useful directly. That's the end product, the end goal. And the eight electrons here are being sent to the electron transport chain. Now, the electron transport chain, physically speaking, is a... And I should say chains. Most books talk about the chain, like there's one. There's millions of chains. They're all copies of each other, but they're all embedded in the inner mitochondrial matrix. The inner mitochondrial membrane. But physically speaking, they are a group of mostly proteins. And so they're able to receive electrons, which means that they get reduced, right? When a chain member receives an electron, it becomes reduced. That means something else must be getting oxidized, right? Well, what's the first thing to get oxidized? The first thing to get oxidized is whatever it is that's dumping its electrons onto the chain to begin with, right? Which is what? NADH, but also FADH2. So those electrons being carried by either one of those coenzymes, NADH or FADH2, those used to be in the fuel, in glucose, if we're thinking about this in terms of glycolysis happening first. They're now being passed from member to member. And like I said, whenever they're passed from one member to the next, they're energetically passed downhill. And that's why... That's why even though there's no fuel left at this point, there's only CO2, the electrons that came from the fuel are still valuable because if you allow them to go energetically downhill one step at a time, you can harness a lot of that energy rather than just releasing it all in one step as heat. And that is what powers oxidative phosphorylation. And even though this is something we're going to talk about the details of in another chapter, you've already gone through this a couple times in previous classes. So you should know already what the transport of electrons in the chains directly accomplishes. Well, I told you that it releases energy a little bit at a time, every time the electrons are passed from member to member. But what does that directly accomplish? Correct. Not ATP production, not directly. What electron transport directly achieves, which is directly powered by the energy loss by those electrons being passed, is the pumping of hydrogen ions. Okay, so that's the essence of respiration in general, not just aerobic respiration, but any sort of respiration that a cell is able to perform. Our cells are aerobic, but remember, not all respiration is aerobic. What really makes it respiration, though, is not the nature of the final electron acceptor, right? The oxygen's role, which is to pick up those electrons in the end, at the end of the chain, that's what makes that particular type of respiration aerobic respiration, because it's oxygen doing the accepting. But in some species, it's some other molecule picking up the electrons at the end, and therefore that would be anaerobic respiration. They're both respiration, though, and what really makes it respiration is the involvement of this membrane across which hydrogen ions are pumped, against their gradient, in other words. Pumping always refers to active transport because you're moving something against its gradient. That's what makes it respiration. And what was temporarily energy that was in the fuel that temporarily is stored as electrons, high energy electrons, that gets spent in electron transport. In other words, the electrons end up at a low level when they're received by oxygen, for instance, in aerobic respiration. Those electrons that end up in oxygen end up very close to a nucleus because oxygen has a high electronegativity, right? So that's a low energy configuration. In other words, the energy that was stored as high energy electrons gets spent when those electrons get passed to the final electron acceptor. So now where is the energy that's going to pay off in terms of ATP? What is the source of energy now that's actually going to be used to phosphorylate ADP into ATP in the final step? Exactly, the concentration gradient of hydrogen ions. That pumping of hydrogen ions will not occur unless those electrons going to lower and lower energy levels release their energy to power that pumping. So you go from storing the energy that was in the fuel in the form of reduced coenzymes to passing those electrons to the chain, which allows for the formation of a proton gradient. And now that is the source of the energy that used to be in the fuel. It's in the form of a proton gradient that you've been able to create. The final payoff then is when you allow those protons to diffuse back to where they've been pumped from. This is being represented here by this green arrow. The pumping isn't really shown, but the electron transport powers the pumping of protons from the matrix to the intermembrane space. So there's a high concentration down here. They then want to come back into the matrix where they've been pumped from by diffusion. Just like water that you put energy into lugging uphill wants to flow back downhill, right? And if you put a water wheel in the way, that water will power the grinding of your corn. Well, here the hydrogen ions diffusing back into the matrix are going to allow for the spinning of ATP synthase molecules, which is what phosphorylates ADP. Okay? So that should be generally familiar with you, but we're going to look at it in greater detail in a different chapter. The whole point here with respect to the citric acid cycle is that the citric acid cycle itself produces a paltry one ATP molecule, even though it spends the rest of the energy in terms of fuel. I mean, it extracts the rest of the energy. But by far, most of that energy is in the form of these electrons being carried by NADH and FADH2, because those electrons are going to allow for the pumping of a lot of protons and therefore the diffusion of a lot of protons back, which has the final payoff of ATP production. And that kind of ATP production is not substrate level phosphorylation. That is oxidative phosphorylation, which is why that's the name of that final step of cellular respiration. Okay? By the way, the ATP that is produced by the citric acid cycle, that's also produced by substrate level phosphorylation, just like the one that's, or just like the ATP that are produced in glycolysis. All right, now let's go on to the particulars of the steps. Slide 4. Oxaloacetate and acetyl coenzyme A condense, as I said, in the first step. Oxaloacetate is coming from the cycle itself. It's the end line. And acetyl coenzyme A is coming in as an input. So CoA is carrying the 2-carbon acetyl group. But the pink thing here is the acetyl coenzyme A. We don't really care about all the complexity of the coenzyme A itself. We care about what it's carrying stuck to the sulfur. So that's the 2-carbon fuel that remains from what started out as glucose. All right, what's happening here really in this condensation is that this methyl group of the acetyl, the CH3 here, is going to connect to this carbon, this carbonyl carbon of oxaloacetate. All right? So that carbonyl carbon in oxaloacetate, of course, has a satisfied valence. It's making four bonds right now, two of them as a double bond and two single bonds. So if you're going to stick something else to it, you're going to have to break that double bond, right? Well, that's what's happening here. This C, this blue C in citral-CoA, which is an intermediate that never leaves the enzyme. It gets formed but immediately transformed into something else. Anyway, this blue C of citral-CoA is what was the carbonyl carbon of oxaloacetate. When you broke that double bond, that allows for the bond between the carbon of the oxaloacetate and the carbon of acetyl. Okay? But doing that is going to free up a bond for oxygen, which is why you have a hydrogen coming in here. The source of that hydrogen is one of the three in the methyl group of acetyl. So a hydrogen, a pink hydrogen from this H3C here, comes off, freeing up a bond for carbon to make this carbon-carbon bond. And the extra oxygen bond that's available after you break the double bond can receive that hydrogen. Okay, so one of these pink hydrogens ends up right here. And we no longer have a double bond. That short-lived intermediate is citral-CoA, but like I said, it's not released as a product from the enzyme. It immediately gets transformed into citrate. But that requires the addition of some water. All right? Now, this two-step process, this is really all step one of the overall cycle, but it has two sub-steps, really. This first part is the condensation part of it, right? When you end up producing citral-CoA, in other words, CoA is carrying a bigger thing, it's carrying six carbons now instead of just two. But then that CoA, that coenzyme A, its connection with this six-carbon citral is going to be severed. That connection is between the sulfur and the citral, the sulfur of coenzyme A, right? Remember, it's always the sulfur of coenzyme A that's doing the carrying of whatever it's carrying. And so that bond is going to be hydrolyzed. Hydrolysis of that bond between sulfur and the citral is going to break that bond. What do we call this bond between the sulfur of coenzyme A and the thing that it's carrying? A thioester bond. Good. Thioester bonds are high energy bonds. So when it's broken in this hydrolysis step, which is why you need the water here, that's going to drive the reaction forward. And what's left is now citrate on its own. Okay? And coenzyme A on its own. Well, this is one place in the cycle that requires water. So that first summary slide that we looked at showed as the only input acetyl-coenzyme A. Water is also an input at two steps. This is one of them. And of course, you can think of oxidized coenzymes as being inputs as well, right? Because they get transformed into reduced coenzymes. And ADP or GDP is also an input, depending on which one's used, because it gets phosphorylated into ATP or GTP. Anyway, though, in this first step, you transform oxaloacetate and acetyl-coenzyme A into a six-carbon compound of citrate. And coenzyme A is now free to leave the situation and go about its business of picking up something else. And for instance, it can go back to pyruvate, the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, and pick up another acetyl group. from pyruvate, right? So it's recycled. Well, the enzyme that is responsible for this first step of the citric acid cycle is called citrate synthase, because it synthesizes citrate. To synthesize means to bring together. So you're bringing together a C2 and a C4 to make the C6 citrate. So the name makes sense, but we're looking at a cartoon version of the enzyme itself here. And we see that it is a homodimer. What is a homodimer? Two what? Same what? What is a dimer more generally? A two-part thing, right? Mer just means subunit. So if an enzyme is a dimer, that means there are two polypeptides that make it up. It's, in other words, it's a quaternary protein. What makes it specifically a homodimer? Yeah, the two individual polypeptides are identical to each other, but there's just two of them. Okay, as opposed to a heterodimer, which would be two different polypeptides stuck together. So even though you can't really tell it from this cartoon, the yellow is has exactly the same shape as the blue, but they come together in this quaternary structure. And this first step, remember, involves as reactants oxaloacetate and acetyl coenzyme A. They are both substrates. But importantly, because of the shape of this thing in the totally unbound conformation, which we see on the left, it's able to bind only one of those substrates. It's able to bind only oxaloacetate. That has to come in first. And what happens when you have the binding of substrate to an enzyme? A conformational change that we call what? Induced fit. Good. That's really important here, because the induced fit that occurs when oxaloacetate binds to the active site of citrate synthase is such that the closing of these subunits around each other then allows for acetyl coenzyme A to come along and bind. The reason that's so important is because if the totally unbound form of citrate synthase had an active site that allowed for acetyl coenzyme A to come in first and bind, all you would do is hydrolyze acetyl coenzyme A. In other words, you would release the acetyl group and coenzyme A on its own, and you wouldn't have the ability to continue the cycle. You would just waste that energy of the fuel, in other words. So by having it occur this way, it's ensured that the acetyl group that coenzyme A is carrying gets stuck on to the oxaloacetate. And so now you have a 6-carbon citronyl group that's being carried by coenzyme A. You still have that thioester bond, which can, now that it's hydrolyzed, yield a 6-carbon citrate molecule, which can allow the cycle to proceed. Does that all make sense? It's all because of the way the shape change occurs when oxaloacetate binds first. Okay, now we're through step one. We already have citrate formed. Next is a reaction that seems kind of silly in the face of it, because it's a two-step process, this next step, that involves first a dehydration. Notice water's coming out. And that's followed up immediately by a hydration, which is the opposite of dehydration. So it seems kind of silly, because why would you do something and then immediately do the opposite? Well, because it allows for the rearrangement of those hydrogens and oxygens on the intermediates. That's why citrate has an OH and an H in pink. Those are the ones that are involved here. They're not in the correct position to be readily dehydrogenated. Okay? We want to prepare this citrate fuel in a way that allows for dehydrogenation, or oxidation in other words, so that we can take advantage of that, of the hydrogens we're going to pick off. So first this H and this OH pop off, and that of course frees up a bond on each of these two carbons, which is why a double bond will form between them. Okay, temporarily. But then immediately an OH and an H from water come back into the situation, but they change their positions. The OH gets stuck to this carbon that had an H before, and the H gets stuck to this carbon which had the OH before. So what is this overall process an example of? Isomerization, exactly. And so the enzyme responsible for this is acting as an isomerase. This intermediate is, once just like before, is not released by the enzyme. It's just a short-lived intermediate that stays on the enzyme and gets immediately transformed. But even though this is functionally acting as an enzyme, as an isomerase, the enzyme is called aconitase because this short-lived intermediate is the cis form of aconitate. Okay, so aconitase is the second enzyme to work. Citrate synthase was first, now aconitase. Aconitase isomerizes citrate into isocitrate, which is named because it's an isomer of citrate. Since this yielded a water and then consumed a water, there is no net requirement of any water here. And that's why this does not count as one of the two places that requires water, right? Because you're producing and using it in the same step, basically. Okay, so now we have isocitrate formed. Slide 7 summarizes step 3. The isocitrate now is going to undergo... Well, you tell me, what is happening here? What would this overall process be called? The overall process. Oxidative decarboxylation, exactly. There's two oxidative decarboxylations that are going to happen in a row. This is the first of them. But it's overall, this overall step 3 is considered an oxidative decarboxylation because there's oxidation happening here first and then decarboxylation. So you're not just getting rid of a CO2 as waste product. You're along the way, you're also harvesting some useful energy in the form of electrons being stripped as hydrogens from that fuel. Okay, that's what happens first. So the isocitrate that step 2 produced is going to be dehydrogenated, and those hydrogens are going to end up in NADH and H+, with a reduced form of the coenzyme. This very short-lived intermediate that also isn't released is oxalosuccinate, and it then is going to lose its carboxyl group, the one in blue, to form alpha-ketoglutarate. Now, that decarboxylation step, this particular decarboxylation step, is the first one of the dismantling of the what's remaining of the fuel. Okay? So this is the second appearance of CO2 in the overall process, but the first appearance of CO2 in the citric acid cycle. Okay, and so this would be the third and fourth carbon from the original glucose. The first and second came from the oxidative decarboxylation of the two pyruvates that came from glycolysis. Okay? Now, since this is a dehydrogenation that's involved here, that's the specific oxidation that's taking place in oxidative decarboxylation. The oxidation is specifically dehydrogenation. And since that's happening to isocitrate, it makes sense to call the enzyme responsible for this isocitrate dehydrogenase. But alpha-ketoglutarate is formed here. Alpha-ketoglutarate is now 5 carbons because one of the carbons has come off of CO2. Now, why is it called this? Well, alpha-ketoglutarate is an example of an alpha-keto acid. What makes it a keto? Well, what makes it an acid, first of all? Yes, the carboxyl group. Anything that has a carboxyl is a carboxylic acid. So this is a carboxylic acid. Why is it a keto acid? Because we have a keto group, which is specifically a carbonyl group that's interior rather than at apical. It's not at the tip. It's somewhere else, right? And it's specifically an alpha keto acid because that carbonyl is directly next to, or one carbon away from, the thing that makes it the acid itself, the carboxyl. In other words, if the carbonyl were down here on this first CH2 instead, then it would be a beta keto acid because it's 2 steps away from the carboxyl. This is an alpha keto acid, though. And so this is alpha ketoglutarate, the 5 carbon intermediate that itself in the next step is going to be oxidatively decarboxylated. Remember, I said there are 2 serial oxidative decarboxylation steps. This was the first one of them. The next one comes next, shown in slide 8. So alpha-ketoglutarate is oxidatively decarboxylated into succinyl coenzyme A. Obviously, coenzyme A must be involved, which is why it's here required as a reactant. NAD plus is required to pick up the hydrogens in the oxidative part of this. And so, just like in the previous step, an NADH is produced. That's useful energy. And then just like in the previous step, a CO2 is spit off. This is the final CO2 now. There's no more carbon left from the original glucose, basically. Although I'll have a little bit something to say about that a little later. This succinyl-CoA, that is the 4-carbon succinyl group that is left after you lose a carbon by decarboxylation, being carried by coenzyme A. Okay, so this, in the decarboxylation, you lose a carbon, so you go from C5 to C4, but the C4 compound, which is the succinyl group, gets latched on to coenzyme A. Now, I just told you that alpha-ketoglutarate is an alpha-keto acid, which it is. Another example of an alpha-keto acid is pyruvate. And remember, we studied in detail the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. What was the enzyme complex responsible for that? Pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, right? Which really acted as 3 enzymes in one. That was the one with the colored circles representing the complex. And the swinging arm. And remember, there were 5 cofactors involved. Do you remember the cofactors? Thiamine, pyrophosphate, lipoic acid, FAD. And those 3 were permanently attached to the complex, right? And then you had two that were acting as substrates. NAD plus and coenzyme A. Exactly the same situation is happening here. It is a different enzyme complex, but structurally very similar to the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. It's called the alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase complex. The details are the same, including the same five coenzymes used in the same way. I mean, the same five cofactors. And so we're not going to go through the chore of looking at the circles again. That same thing applies to this, basically. It's another enormous complex transforming this alpha keto acid, in this case alpha ketoglutarate, into something being carried by coenzyme A, in this case succinyl coenzyme A instead of acetyl coenzyme A, and NADH is produced, carbon dioxide is released. It's totally analogous to the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Right? Let's go on then. Like I said, at this point, all the carbons from the original skeleton have been dismantled, but you still have these intermediates that are produced along the way as a way of regenerating or recycling oxaloacetate, which you need to start with. And that's not an unimportant process. I mean, it's important to get back to oxaloacetate, but importantly in terms of energetics, along that way, those rearrangements are such that you get even more energy out of the situation in terms of not only electrons being stuck onto coenzymes, FAD and NADH, FAD and NAD plus receive them, but also in terms of the phosphorylation of an ADP into ATP via substrate level phosphorylation. So that all happens from here on out to get back to the start finish line. Succinyl coenzyme A is what is spit out from this previous process, right? From the alpha ketoglutarate dehydrogenation complex, that enzyme complex produces succinyl coenzyme A. Then we have an inorganic phosphate in solution, also acting as a reactant here, and GDP. Now, it's GDP if it happens to be the version of the enzyme that uses GDP instead of ATP. It could also be ATP. Like I said, that depends on species for one thing, but even in your own body, it would depend on the tissue. In your muscle tissues, it would be ADP instead of GDP. In your liver, it's more likely to be GDP rather than ADP. So that means there's two different versions of the enzyme that's responsible for this step. One that uses ADP and one that uses GDP. But they do otherwise exactly the same thing, and therefore they qualify as what? They qualify as isozymes, right? Different proteins that are acting as enzymes that do exactly the same thing, but just in different situations. Okay. Well, the enzyme responsible for doing this, the transformation of succinyl coenzyme A into succinate, is called succinyl coenzyme A synthetase. And this one happens to be named for the reverse reaction. The name synthetase implies that something is being synthesized, right? If you think about this in reverse, succinyl coenzyme A would be synthesized in the process. And so this is a reversible reaction within this cycle. And the liver, for instance, runs it in reverse in certain situations because the liver is anabolic. But it also brings up the You might have noticed that the first enzyme, what was that first enzyme in the cycle called? Citrate synthase. This one is called a synthetase, not a synthase. Succinyl coenzyme A synthetase. They both, well, nowadays, synthase and synthetase can be used kind of interchangeably. There's no distinction anymore. There used to be a distinction, though, and these old names just keep hanging around because people grow up with them or whatever and keep using them. The original distinction was, though, that a synthetase synthesizes something using a nucleoside triphosphate, ATP or GTP. Okay, so in the reverse, GTP would be used here, or ATP in the other version, to do the synthesis. Well, that wasn't the case in the first step, right? Citrate is synthesized without using ATP. It's using the energy of the thioester bond instead. And so synthases were things that were named for enzymes that synthesize things without ADP or ATP or GTP, whereas synthetases require ATP or GTP. But then sometime recently they decided there is no really, we shouldn't even make that distinction. So when you see the two names, those are just kind of old-fashioned names. They really refer to synthesis in either case, though. But to add to the complexity, in this case, it's actually named for the reverse reaction, not the forward reaction that occurs as part of the citric acid cycle. So we're still have a 4-carbon. That's not going to change, right? Because all the remaining steps of the cycle are just rearrangements of that 4-carbon skeleton. But importantly, in this one, it's more than just a rearrangement. It's also a freeing of that 4-carbon compound from the thing that's carrying it, which is coenzyme A. So coenzyme A now pops off. It's on its own. And it can go do the job of coenzyme A, which is various. But for instance, it can go back to the previous step, right, which required coenzyme A. It can go back and allow the previous step to continue. So it's recycled, coenzyme A is. But also importantly, the GDP or the ATP, depending on the situation, gets phosphorylated into either a GTP or an ATP. And like I said before, if it is GDP that's being used, like in a liver cell, the GTP that results immediately drops off its phosphate to an ADP. And so this is done by a nucleoside diphosphate kinase enzyme. Right? One nucleoside diphosphate receives a phosphate from another thing. So a nucleoside diphosphate is being phosphorylated. Therefore, it's a nucleoside diphosphate kinase that's doing that. But the whole point of this is that even if it is GTP that's produced, it's going to get turned into, it's going to lead to the production of an ATP. Now, in slide 10, we're looking at a closer view of, the only view we've looked at, of the enzyme that's responsible for this, which is succinyl coenzyme A synthetase. So this yellow thing represents the business end of the enzyme, and it's the same thing in all five of these views. This is just going through steps along the way. And at first, notice that we have succinyl coenzyme A, the substrate, coming in and binding to the active site. The pink thing is orthophosphate. And why is it called orthophosphate? Yes, it's by itself. In other words, it's inorganic. It's not connected to anything. It's just part of the phosphate pool that's in all cells. Because phosphates are being shuffled around all the time, right? So the phosphate comes in this first part and displaces the coenzyme A. Coenzyme A, therefore, leaves on its own. And by the way, I'll notice that this is shown as a reversible reaction in this slide. So now, instead of having succinyl coenzyme A, you have succinyl phosphate. Succinyl phosphate is a molecule that has a high phosphoryl transfer potential, which means it's willing to put that phosphate onto something else. Well, notice that there is a histidine residue represented by that ring and labeled as HIS. That's part of the enzyme, right? A histidine is an amino acid. So this histidine residue is just one of the amino acid residues in the overall protein that is the enzyme. But it's hanging off in the active site, and it's able to work as a swinging arm, basically. And so in this next step, this succinyl phosphate, which has a high phosphoryl transfer potential, will willingly give up that phosphate it just received to the histidine residue. Okay? Well, this is no longer a succinyl group because it's not attached to anything else. It's now succinate in its own right, which is coming off of the situation, but that's going to be what feeds the next reaction. Okay? But to reset to finish the overall process that's going on here, the phosphate that's now on histidine, that now is called phosphohistidine, descriptively enough. And phosphohistidine has a fairly high phosphoryl transfer potential itself, so it's willing to give up the phosphate to something else. That something else is either ADP or GDP, depending on which version of this synthetase molecule you're working with. In this version, it shows you as ADP, even though the previous slide it said GTP. Those are the two isozymes I was talking about, okay? But in any case, one of the two versions of the nucleoside diphosphate comes in and picks up the phosphate from the phosphohistidine. That makes either ATP or GTP, and it leaves just histidine, which was there originally. It resets the enzyme into its original configuration, ready to go again, assuming that there's more succinyl coenzyme A coming down the line. All right? That was succinyl coenzyme A synthetase, named for its reverse reaction, actually. Slide 11 is the rest of the cycle, but there are three steps being shown here all at once. So the first step is to take the succinate that just got produced in the previous step and do what to it? Well, you're transforming it into fumarate, but what is that process? By looking at this picture. It is oxidation, and specifically via what? What's actually happening here in this oxidation? Well, this is why they're using color coding here. The black part is not being changed. The blue things are being changed. Right. This is a dehydrogenation. And so that explains why the enzyme responsible for this is called succinate dehydrogenase. But the hydrogens that are stripped from the succinate in this dehydrogenation reaction get delivered to the coenzyme flavin adenine dinucleotide, FAD. So it reduces that FAD into FADH2. One of the four coenzyme molecules that the citric acid cycle reduces. And one of two different coenzymes. The other three are all NAD+. This one is FAD, though. And this brings up another point about this. Succinate dehydrogenase is the only citric acid cycle enzyme that is bound. It's membrane bound. Specifically, it is part of the inner mitochondrial membrane. The other enzymes involved in this cycle are free enzymes, meaning they are just in the matrix. They're not attached to a membrane. And so they're able to move around, basically. The FAD isn't. And in fact, when this FAD receives the two hydrogens to become reduced into FADH2, the FADH2 immediately drops its two hydrogens off. By dropping off the two hydrogens, you're freeing up two electrons, two protons, right? The two protons will be in solution. The two electrons get immediately dropped off to electron transport chain, which is also part of the membrane. So succinate dehydrogenase is positioned in that membrane right next to a player in that electron transport chain, one of the members of that electron transport chain, specifically coenzyme Q, but we'll talk about that detail later. Okay? And so this FAD, as soon as it drops it off, is going to be FADH2 is going to get reoxidized into FAD in that process immediately. Doesn't leave the enzyme, basically, because it's because of that membrane binding. Okay. The dehydrogenation of the succinate results in fumarate. Once again, we haven't changed the number of carbons. We're just rearranging the skeleton now. We're still with four carbons, but that dehydrogenation produces this double bond because each of those carbons loses a bond, so they have to double up to maintain their valence satisfaction. The next step then is to hydrate the fumarate. This is the second place in the cycle I mentioned earlier that requires water, because we didn't count the hydration that was happening at the same time as the dehydration, right? That was no net requirement of water. This is a net requirement of water. So the H2O is coming in, as you see here. And this step doesn't yield any usable energy, but it reorganizes the carbon skeleton in such a way that we can then get some energy out of it with another dehydrogenation step. So in the process of being hydrated, fumarate gets transformed into malate. And this enzyme is simply named for its substrate. The enzyme is called fumarase. Okay? Notice what happens. The double bond is broken. Water, which is a hydroxyl and a hydrogen, get hooked to the two different carbons that used to have a double bond between them. That's what makes malate. And malate then is dehydrogenated in the final step. So this is another oxidation, but specifically it's another dehydrogenation. Those hydrogens that just got put onto there from water now get picked off and end up reducing NAD plus into NADH. So once again, that's useful energy. That's the final bit of useful energy, this final NADH that's produced in the conversion of malate into oxaloacetate. That's the end of the line, right? Because when you get oxaloacetate, you're back to the beginning. So that's the entire cycle. We'll finish up the chapter next time.